Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and today on the show we begin by taking a look at science. You know, scientists use what they call the scientific method as a way to answer questions in a systematic way, and that method has resulted in many, many new technologies, medicine, countless other discoveries. And to talk about science with us, once again, Bassam Shakashiri. Bassam's a UW Madison Professor Emeritus of Chemistry, former Assistant Director for Science and Engineering Education at the National Science Foundation. And it's going to be fun exploring science with him today. And I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have relating to science? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Bassam, welcome back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you for the continued opportunities to visit with you and your listening audience to talk about science, to talk about connecting science with society. You provide so many opportunities on your program, not only today, but throughout the week. And I want to start by thanking you and saluting you for doing that. It's so critical that we do this.
Well, thank you, Bassam. And you have been promoting science and a basic understanding of science for a long, long time, not only on this program, but professionally and otherwise. Why is it so important to you?
We live in the most advanced society in history, and these advances are because of science and technology. They're because people appreciate science, people support scientific inquiry, people learn, people want to satisfy their curiosities, people want to develop new technologies to help improve the quality of life in society. You know, Larry, science and technology are the engines that drive our economy. Economic prosperity is very dependent on new technologies, innovation, transferring basic research results to the market. It's really, really very important that we all develop a sense of appreciation of science and learn about you know, what science deals with. It does not deal with all human concerns and domains, but learn what science is, what we can benefit from science, and how it helps us. You know, the Industrial Revolution has resulted in us being the way we are now. We enjoy life. Lifespan has increased. Healthcare is much better. Transportation, communications. We can go down the list here. But we are now in the infancy of the electronic revolution. And we must pay close attention to that so that with artificial intelligence and other aspects of it, biotechnology, that we have a sense of responsibility for handling and dealing with the wonderful things that can result, but also with the adverse problems that can develop. So that's essentially why I and so many other people feel that connecting science with society is crucial to the well-being of each one of us, individually and collectively, in communities, in groups, no matter what our religious beliefs are, no matter what our political affiliations are, we live in the most advanced society in history, and we have an awesome responsibility not only to enjoy it, Larry, but to maintain it and to sustain it.
You know, I was thinking, as you were talking, I was thinking back. It's been, I believe, more than 20 years ago that you founded the Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy at UW-Madison. I think you're still its director. Talk about that initiative. What does that initiative do?
Well, very briefly and succinctly, I hope, the mission of the Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy is to promote literacy in science, mathematics, and technology among the general public, and also to attract future generations to careers in research, scientific research, in teaching, and in public service. This is the succinct statement of purpose of the initiative. Now, why science literacy? Science and science literacy are necessary for the democratic process to work. Science literacy enlightens and enables people to make informed choices and to be skeptical. In science, we're always skeptical, Larry. We ask questions. We challenge authority. We want to really know how the world works and how our role in the world contributes to the well-being of not only each other, but to the survival of the planet. So we want to enable people to make informed choices, to be skeptical, and to reject shames, quackery, unproven conjecture, and to avoid being bamboozled into making foolish decisions where matters of science and technology are concerned. This is the essence, and this is the heart of what the Initiative for Science Literacy is about. And we aim to learn from each other, work with each other in respectful ways, and we hope that we are able to enjoy what we do. We might disagree with each other, but our disagreement should be civil in the way we interact with each other, no matter how strongly we disagree with each other.
Yeah. Well, that initiative is really linked to something I really enjoy. Your website, which is Science is Fun, includes a lot of information, including what I think are pretty cool science activities that you can do at home. And people, what do people learn from doing their own science experiments?
We can learn a lot. But Larry, may I just say one more thing about science literacy?
Sure.
Science literacy is an attitude. Attitudes do not develop overnight. They have to be nurtured. They have to be nourished. They have to be part of continuous and continual engagement with each other. So science literacy, it's like personal hygiene. It's everyone should have an appreciation of science. Some people want to have a deep understanding of science. And we promote all that together. We do it together. So the website is one attempt to do that. We have a variety of entries on the website, including experiments you can do at home. If you go to the website, which is scifun.org, in the upper left corner, you click on the entry there, and you see that we have a whole variety of experiments you can do at home safely. I invite people who are in the listening audience to visit the website, check the experiments you can download and do at home, but please do not do them alone. They're very safe to do. I say do not do them alone because I'm a strong advocate of family interactions around topics that are meaningful to youngsters and to adults. So do experiments. They're safe to do at home. They have been tested repeatedly. Everything has been reviewed carefully. Everything on my website has been carefully reviewed. But the experimentation, hands-on experiments, are really important to cultivate an attitude that, as I keep saying, helps us understand the world that we live in and learn that it's all right to ask questions and it's all right to say, I don't know, when the question is asked, but there are ways to find out.
You know, the Institute for Science Literacy Project, it has a project, I think it's the newest one. It's called The Science of Sound, which is pretty cool. Here we are. We're a hearing medium at Wisconsin Public Radio and radio in general. But tell us about the Science of Sound project.
So if you go to the website, scifund.org, on the homepage, you'll see a variety of entries, but the newest one is called The Science of Sound. And take your cursor and hover a bit around over the Science of Sound entry before you click on it, and you'll see what happens. Why the Science of Sound? Well, you know, we're interested in sharing information, developing knowledge about hearing, and it's one of the senses. It's an important aspect of enables us to communicate with each other. So there's a pressure pulse that is responsible for the sensation of sound. And this, when the sound wave enters the ear, it produces the sensation. So these pulses, these pressure pulses in the air, you have to have a medium to have this pressure pulse. That travels through the air and hits the ear, enters the ear canal, and when the inner ear, the different parts of the ear, the inner part of the canal, that causes pulses that strike the eardrum, and the pulses cause the drum to move in and out. That's why it's called an eardrum. These motions of the ear drum are then transferred to a series of several bones that are in there, and they transmit the motion to the cochlea. In the cochlea, there's the motion is converted to electrical signals, and the electrical signals are sent to the brain. So this is the introduction to how hearing works, and how the how we hear.
It's pretty cool. I was thinking back. I interviewed Daniel Levitin, who's written a book. I heard there was a secret chord, music as medicine, and it brings to bear a lot of the science about how music can serve in a variety of medical situations. A very fascinating book. I think I interviewed him on August 26th, so if anybody wants to go back and listen to that particular show, they can do it. And of course, we're really interested in sound here at Wisconsin Public Radio. How did the project come about? I mean, what was the genesis for it?
We've been involved for decades in developing material to share with faculty, with teachers, high school teachers, grade school teachers, with the public at large about science. And we published a series of books called Chemical Demonstrations. And the fifth volume dealt with color, light, vision, and perception. Those five volumes are printed volumes. Now, for the Science of Sound, which you might consider the next volume in the series, although it's not printed, we put it on the web, and my colleague, my long-time friend and colleague, Rodney Schreiner, is responsible for putting all this material together. He's just a very insightful, highly knowledgeable and caring person who put all the pieces that you will be able to look at when you visit the Science of Sound on the web. So we consider this to be a continuation of the series of ways by which we like to share the joy of learning. We like to ask questions. We like to have people formulate their own questions. We like to try to help satisfy curiosities. We try to nurture curiosity. So that's the continuation of the series that we've been doing. And it's in keeping with modern technology now. We're not abandoning print, but we're saying this is a highly interactive entry. And I would like to invite people to visit the website and tell us back what they think about it, what questions they have, how to change it, how to improve it. And because the entries on the web are all living documents. So Rodney Schreiner and I and others on the staff welcome hearing from people who have questions, comments about not only the science of sound, but about everything that we have on the website.
Yeah. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today, the William T. Abu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin at the UW-Madison. Great to have him with us. And we'll invite you to join in now. If you have a question or comment, I hope you will. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News as we talk science with Bassam Shakashiri. We were just talking about the science of sound, and I want to give a big thanks to everybody who heard our request during our fall member drive. Thanks to everybody who donated during the fall member drive. We had people like Vicky and Two Rivers helping there and making WPR's essential service possible. If you missed the member drive, still time to join in. You could go to WPR.org and make a contribution. Now more, I think more than ever, you play a very important role in keeping Wisconsin informed, inspired, and connected. And thanks again for helping us out with that very strong WPR member drive. Really appreciate it. Everyone here appreciates your contributions. Well, science is happening all around us all the time. Bassam, and I think it was last Monday, we celebrated the autumnal equinox. That, of course, marks the official start of fall in the Northern Hemisphere. And if I'm not mistaken, the official start of spring in the Southern Hemisphere. But let's talk about the autumnal equinox. What is it exactly?
The equinox is, of course, twice a year. It's when the Earth's axis is tilted neither toward nor away from the sun. It's straight up to the sun, which results in having an equal amount of daylight and darkness all over the world. So people know that the Earth is tilted, right, Larry?
Yeah.
People know why we have four seasons, and maybe we should think about that. We've talked about this several times before. Why do we have four seasons? The fall equinox is the beginning of the fall season, and it occurred, as you say, a week ago in the Northern Hemisphere. So in the Southern Hemisphere, it's the beginning of spring. I think it's important for us to enjoy learning about these events that happen, and also enjoy looking at the changes that accompany those events. So it's really important to learn about. The word equinox comes from Latin, right? It means equal, mm-hmm. and it has to do. In this connection, I'd like to once again, as I have done before on your program, Larry, refer people to a study that was done about 40 years ago, asking students and faculty members at Harvard University why we have four seasons. And this is a program called the Private Universe. I will put a link to that on my website, and perhaps you can also do it again.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of not knowing. It's a matter of saying, I don't know, and we can find out. In this study, 23 out of 25 Harvard faculty members did not know the correct explanation as to why we have four seasons. At least in this interview, they did not know. So, but this is a telltale of how important it is for all of us, not only to be subspecializing in areas of knowledge, in areas of business, but to have a wider perspective about what the environment is that we live in. And again, especially among youngsters, to nurture and nourish curiosity.
You know, I bet there are a few thousand people are wondering to themselves, wait a minute, why do we have four seasons? Maybe you could take a minute and just explain how that works.
Well, the Earth the axis of the Earth is tilted. And so rotation and they're going around the sun. We do agree that the Earth goes around the sun, right, Larry?
I think so.
Well, that's because of science and because of common understanding, and that we agree to that. Okay, then as the tilt continues and the rotation continues, the tilt goes away from being straight up toward the sun, and that's why we have the differences in the amount of sunlight that comes during the day, of course, to our planet. And again, the differences between the northern and southern hemispheres. And all of this is related to climate change and related to understanding the beautiful, complex world that we live in.
Yeah.
Once again, I invite everyone to ask questions and perhaps visit my website, and we can provide more detailed information, not only about the four seasons, but about all the topics that relate to science and technology that we have brought up today.
Yeah. Well, you did mention climate change, and let's talk about, for maybe a minute or two, about the economic and environmental consequences we can expect from the effects of climate change.
Well, climate change is unequivocal, and it's important for us to understand why this is happening, how it's happening, and what we can do about it. Let's just take two specific examples from Wisconsin. The duration of ice on the surface of Lake Mendota has been tracked for many, many years. And the duration of ice, that period is getting shorter and shorter. That is one telltale of that the planet is warming. That's one of the telltales. And another one is the so-called plant hardiness zones. Those are the zones that gardeners and farmers use to put the seeds in and so on. And it's very clear that these zones now are shifting in a direction that tells us that the temperature is getting warmer. Once again, I have graphic displays of what I'm saying here on the website, and they are on other websites too, and the other guys talk about this too. So I invite you to look at the science of climate change. It's an entry we have on the website. All of these displays critically show that the planet is warming. So the economic consequences of this, well, you know, I mentioned farming. Then there are situations where the areas around the planet become drier.
Oh, I think we temporarily lost Bassam Shakashiri here for a minute. We'll get him back. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today, and I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts about science. Maybe it has to do with climate change or other things that we've talked about relating to science, or maybe you've got something else to bring up. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could go to talk@WPR.org. Send us an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll take a quick break and then we'll be back with Bassam. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk science with Bassam Shakashiri. We lost him there for a minute, but we have him back. And Bassam, as you were talking, and we lost you there, you were talking about climate change effects, and you were using an example of Wisconsin agriculture.
Yes, I was. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was using the example of what's called the plant hardiness zones. This is a very clear indication of how winter temperatures are changing, and this affects farming, for example. There are other. So I was inviting our listening audience to look at this graphical display of the plant hardiness zones. They're on my website, scifund.org. And they are on other websites too. And learn more about the science of climate change and the consequences of what is happening to the planet. So that's important that we learn about that. And I use the example about the surface of the ice on the surface of Lake Mendota.
Yeah.
You heard that, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Marion Spooner has a question relating to what we were just talking about. Mary, go ahead. Thank you for calling.
Okay. I would just like a little bit more information about the reasons for the four seasons, and you mentioned the tilting of the axis, but could you elaborate a little bit more on how this works? Does it have to do with the rotation of the Earth around the sun, or?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Earth is going around its own axis as well. That's but the Earth is also moving around the sun, and the relationship between the rotation around the axis as it changes with time as we go around the sun is what gives us daylight, of course, and nighttime, but also gives us the with the tilt, then it changes the amount of daylight that happens, and that is the reason, that is the explanation for why we have the four seasons.
Mary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Michael in DeForest, we'll go to you. Michael, hello.
Hello. I have an interesting question. I would like to know if we will ever get to the point where we no longer need science, then we will know it all. And what percent are we in advancement on science in history?
Oh, All right.
That's a very, very good question. I'll tell you, the more we know, the more we realize how little we know. Science will continue to help us understand the world that we live in. Technology will also help us, I hope, live better with each other. There are ways by which technology can be extremely helpful, and also technology can cause harm. So the nature of the human mind is to ask questions and seek explanations and answers. And in science, the explanations and the answers change because we learn more. We get better at asking questions. So science, to borrow from a book that was published in the 1950s, science is the endless frontier. We just keep at it. Does that help with your question?
Yes. Where do you think we're at in advancement in science? I mean, compared to human history and science, whereabouts are we as far as how much we know?
Well, as I said, we know a lot more now than we did before. But we also realize that what we know is so small compared to what we can learn. And that's why we pursue scientific research. That's why we have disciplined approaches to formulating questions and trying to come up with answers and explanations to those questions. I dare say that the end of science would be the end of curiosity, and that's not going to happen.
Yeah. I was thinking back, I think it was in the 50s, maybe early 50s, where someone made the pronouncement, someone, that we had learned everything that we would ever learn. And that there, we had advanced to the point where we could probably will never advance further than we were. That was in 1950, thereabouts. And you can see that if you think back to where we were in 1950 and where we are in 2025, it's been a whole range of improvements and learning. And I bet you, in 50 years from now, what scientists will be talking about is this will be looked at as a period of pretty good, but nothing like what we've got now.
I agree with what you're saying, Larry, and I think everyone has the right to say whatever they want to say, but to say that we've learned as much as we can learn, that is that's perhaps a telltale of not understanding enough about the nature of human beings.
Michael, thank you very much for calling. We've still got a long way to go on the science side, but we've made a lot of advancements. John in Janesville, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I just had listened in about the four seasons, and I'm an old geography teacher, and that was one of my first things with my seventh grade students. The question of why, rather than memorizing all of the data for the various, the Tropic of Cancer and when does the sun hit there at a 90-degree angle and so on, and those are all important things. But trying to explain why something does happen rather than just, will you just memorize this? And I think that's what science is trying to, why did a city grow so big here when it didn't someplace else, or what, there's reasons for what we've done. So I think sometimes we're losing sight of the why and asking those questions. And I don't know, maybe we don't want to know the real true answers maybe. So
No, we want to know. We want to know. What are you talking about? I say that respectfully, right? You know that, right?
Yeah. John, thank you very much. Thanks for your comment, John. Appreciate it. Winona, who is driving through Keeble, has something for us. Winona, hi.
Hi. Hi. Well, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to first mention that for the last two summers, I've been teaching math science in our local public school as a summer school class. And we have not done a lot of what the kids call the advanced experiments, which involve things exploding. We've done a lot of documenting and evidence work and questions and using critical thinking skills. And even though they don't always like it at first, by the end of the 4 weeks, they're doing it and they're appreciating it. But my question, because it's starting to come up more, is how do we handle if we believe that science is important, and yes, you should be skeptical, and you should be curious. How do we handle the way it's been politicized, especially over the last couple of years, and in some cases really diminished in terms of attitudes about science?
Yeah.
That's my question.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Bassam?
Yeah, very good question. Thank you. We have to think hard and improve the ways in which we share scientific knowledge with each other. We do this formally in the classroom, but we also do it outside the classroom. And so it is part of the awesome responsibility of scientists to pursue scientific research, but it's also incumbent upon us to share the results of these pursuits in manners, in ways that are appreciated by audiences in the classroom and outside the classroom. So I think it's an important part, not only to improve the methods of communication, but to think about why we want this communication to happen, and to also, in the process of communication, to listen to each other. Communication is not a one-way street. Education is not a one-way street. I learned so much as a classroom teacher and also from being outside the classroom as I probably learned from having been a student in the classroom. So the attitude that we have about connecting science with society should be examined, and individuals and groups and communities should think about how this can be improved so that it becomes effective. And I have great admiration for my colleagues and the science faculty and for high school teachers, grade school teachers, who want to do a better job of teaching science. It's not only memorizing the facts, as a previous caller was saying. It is about the process of science, the inquiry that we engage in, and how we work with each other, and how skeptical we are about an answer that we might come up with. As I say, I keep emphasizing the word solutions more so than answers. So we have to think about sharing science with society now differently than what we have done in the past. What do I mean by that? I mentioned already that the electronic revolution is in its infancy. So we have to find ways to better use technology, educational technology, to not only share information and share knowledge, but to engage in meaningful, respectful dialogues about what is being shared. So this is a challenge to all of us.
Dave, thank you for calling. David and Phillips has something that relates, I believe. David, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for this call and this program. I wondered if you think that Thomas Kuhn's fundamental book on the structure of scientific revolutions should somehow be, you know, interpreted or, you know, brought back as trying to find a common ground understanding of the paradigms of scientific inquiry, because it seems to me that people have fundamental differences on how they think, and in doing so, they might, you know, we might be experiencing, as we are now, you know, rejection of good science by people who just think about it differently. So I wondered if you could comment on Kuhn's book, and if it should be brought back in a more functional way.
Sort of a paradigm. Yes. Paradigm
yes,
shift. Yeah, go ahead, Sam.
Yes, we should all have a look at Tom Kuhn's book. There's no question about it. And to understand what he was addressing, it is exactly along the lines that you're mentioning. So there is the understanding that scientists themselves have about what they do and how they do it. There's also the understanding, and I hope appreciation, of what scientists communicate to people who are not scientists. I'm a firm believer in that science and society have a social contract that enables great intellectual achievements. But this social contract comes with expectations of benefiting the human condition and protecting our planet. And these paradigm shifts that you're talking about, that Thomas Kuhn talked about, should be part of the conversation. We should all express ourselves about that. We should participate. I want to underscore the word participate. We should participate in dialogues among each other, with each other, about such matters. And Larry, your program does a wonderful job in this regard. And I, as I mentioned earlier, I want to thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you. David, appreciate your call. And this, I did want to, before we, well, we still have time, but I wanted to bring up the Wisconsin Science Festival that's coming up. It's, you know, it started, I think it was 3 days. Now it's 10 days with events taking place in all 52 counties. Give us a little on the Wisconsin Science Festival.
Oh, it's a marvelous opportunity. It's been expanded, as you just said, to 10 days. This is the 15th annual Wisconsin Science Festival. It will be held from October 16th. Till October 26th, all over the state in 52 counties, and it celebrates discoveries in science. It encourages people to ask questions, to do experiments. It also celebrates the all important connection between the arts and the sciences, and there's so many different programs. I invite people to visit the Wisconsin Science Festival website, where all of these events are mentioned all over the state. Just Google Wisconsin Science Festival 2025. The theme of the festival is Curiosity Unleashed. So many wonderful programs, shining spotlights, as I said, on the arts woven into science. Programs like sound waves, crossroads of ideas, bringing performance and science together in creative ways. Their curiosity fuels creativity. It's a wonderful set of activities for every person in the family, from youngsters to grandparents and great-grandparents. You're all invited to do this, to really enjoy the interactions also between people who do scientific research and the public on topics relating how to humanize science, how to build trust,
how to show how research connects to everyday life and has practical implications, and also to address the very all-important, challenging current climate of supporting scientific research in our country. This is a very important aspect of what's going to happen in the Science Festival. So the Wisconsin Science Festival, all are invited to participate in this. And I'm so happy and pleased with this, now the 15th annual Wisconsin Science Festival.
And it's occurring, it's bound to be in an area near you because it's in 52 of our 72 counties. So practically the biggest portion of the counties of the state are having this science festival, and well worth your time for sure. We have Mary in Gladstone, Michigan has a question or comment. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I know that ever since the, and probably well before the development of the atomic bomb, we've known that there are some hazards related to progress in science and risks. And I'm just wondering where, how you view this huge, huge growth in AI, and who knows where we'll go from here in terms of the hazards of progress in science.
Yeah, thanks, Mary.
That's a very, very important question for all of us to know about and to think about. So AI has many great benefits to all of us, but it also can lead to potential hazards and damage. And we need to understand what is really happening right now. Things are changing on a daily basis in artificial intelligence, and it's very hard to keep up with that. But we should devote part of our time on a weekly basis, maybe on a daily basis, to learn more about what artificial intelligence consequences might be. There are conversations among people to develop standards of ethics for that. Well, how can they be enforced? So this is a very important aspect of human development that relates to advances in science and technology, so we can not only benefit, but also protect ourselves and protect our planet.
Had some nice emails as well, Paulette. Every Monday, her theme as a teacher was science experiments. They invited students to experiment at home and bring in to share with class. The curiosity was piqued and many questions were asked. She only wishes she would have had your website, scifund.org, to use as a resource. And so as we close here, I want to just remind people, the things we talked about today you're going to find on scifund.org. And Bassam, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll look forward to another visit from you. Thank you, Bassam.
Thank you, Larry, for the opportunity once again. Thank you so much.
Bassam Shakashiri, an emeritus professor of chemistry and the William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA at UW-Madison. Great to have him along. And great to welcome up next our weather guys to talk climate and weather. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.